Hello and welcome to 42 Talks, the podcast which takes a deep dive into the legal world led by the experienced members of 42 BR Barristers. I'm Tina Cook, a member of the family team at 42 BR, and I'm delighted to be joined by Jennifer Youngs to discuss covert recordings. Jennifer did a lecture in March 2024 along with Lee Kelleher, and that will be on the 42 BR Barristers website. But we give this talk because, well, we're really just going to have a chat. Don't worry too much. It's going to be 20 minutes max, we absolutely promise, so you can listen to it on the tube or in the car. Because the Family Justice Council has just issued updated guidance, slightly different, but not much to the earlier guidance. We find it interesting that many people make covert recordings because of a lack of trust in the court system and in the justice system. But we think it goes much beyond the culture of how non-lawyers perceive the court process. And we were struck by the similarity of the thrust of advice on covert recording and also transparency in courts. And it was interesting that the president, a couple of weeks ago, 16th of May, at the Resolutions Conference, as part of his speech to the Resolutions Conference, said the following. I'm just going to read out a very short quote. You'll have to look at the whole of the speech to get the whole context. But I think it makes the point that covert recordings are obvious because of people's lack of understanding and lack of trust. And what he said was, but being transparent is about much more than simply allowing a journalist to report what they see. Being transparent is an attitude of mind that should infect all that we do. The aim is to be open and to be seen rather than closed and hidden. This involves talking in the public space and in media about what happens in the family court. It involves leadership judges inviting local media representatives and local MPs into the court building and explaining who we are and what we do. It involves having access to and then publishing accurate data. This is very much work in progress, and it will be a mistake to think that with the rule change about journalists now in place, we have in some way got transparency done. Whilst what has occurred thus far has been great achievement by all those involved, be they judges, lawyers, court staffs or journalists, there is still much to do. And in the sense that being transparent is a continuing state, the work can never be said to be finished. And we were just really struck by, you know, the motivation, and we'll come to the motivation in a moment, for making covert recordings. And we've all been there. We've all had clients say, I've recorded this social work, I've recorded this, I've recorded the other. How the transparency might reduce the need to do that. So, Jennifer, could you just start by just keying us up with really what, as far as the advice, the Family Justice Council advice is concerned, is what is a covert recording?
Well, in essence, I think it is just a recording that the person that you are recording doesn't know is happening. And that can be in a various different contexts. The sort of three headings, I think, that we used in the previous seminar that we did were broadly recording of professionals, and that's much more likely, I think, to occur in a public law context, potentially, when you are exposed to a number of professionals. And then the other two types being recordings of children and recordings of other members of the family. So those were the broad three types that we categorised when we spoke about this previously. I think it's interesting, Tina, that you said that you have had experience of clients who have recorded professionals in the context of your work. Certainly I've come across it more in the context of private proceedings when parents have been recording each other or the children. So I don't know if you could perhaps set out a specific example as far as you're able.
Absolutely can. I had one that really springs to mind is a client who recorded everything, absolutely everything, every conversation. I'm jolly sure she recorded me. But, you know, in the same way the guardians are given advice, and perhaps we'll come to that, maybe we won't have time, you really ought to be only saying things to clients and saying things within your professional domain, which you mean and which you can explain and justify ex post facto. So as much as I'm sure she did record me, she was recording social workers going into the home, and then she would play them back to me when the social worker was giving the evidence, before which point I didn't know. And she would say, but that wasn't said. And it wasn't said. And so a couple of cases which we know about, which are referred to in the guidance, the new guidance and the old guidance, and the authorities, which highlights situations precisely like that, where I think one you'll recall and you discussed it in your seminar, where somebody was in a foster care situation and the evidence was X and she had been recording it. And in fact, there had been all sorts of horrible racial comments to the mother in the foster care situation. And of course, unless she'd recorded it, the court wouldn't have believed her. So it's a very difficult thing. And the advice that we are now getting from the Family Justice Council would have been enormously helpful to me at the time when I did this case 4 or 5 years ago, because it deals with what you are to do. And perhaps we'll come to that, what you are to do. And the welfare of the child is priority, and it's going to waste a lot of time very often. And sometimes there's hundreds and hundreds. There were hundreds of hours of this lady's recordings. And she said, oh, no, just wait a moment, I can find that. The judge took a very dim view of it, and we were allowed to use some of it. It was acutely embarrassing because, of course, you're hit by a client in mid-proceedings saying, well, that wasn't said, it was this. And you can understand with that lack of trust, Jennifer. Interestingly to me, in what you mentioned, the private situation, how the Family Justice Council draft advice and advice that came out a couple of weeks ago, the final advice, really deprecates children being involved in this in any way, shape, or form. I mean, of course, it's obvious, but I was struck by the fact that the draft advice sort of said, yeah, we don't encourage it. And the final advice is a lot firmer, isn't it, on that?
Yes, and I think that is the context in which I have encountered it, is in a private law setting, and often where the parent who has recorded the child thinks that that's sort of their trump card in their case so that they can establish what has happened. And in fact, the court takes a very negative view of that behaviour because it's seen, for example, as not having prioritised the child's welfare, and there are the usual concerns around coaching and what may have been said before that recording started. And in fact, I have had a case where it was adduced by one party and then sought not to be relied upon. So it had been adduced in pre-hearing correspondence. But then my client said, no, we need to admit these because actually they help my case because they show what the other parent has been saying to this child. So it is interesting, I think, the distinction between the criticism that you might encounter in a private law context as opposed to this increased push towards further transparency in the public law context. And actually, the importance of professionals being open might lend itself to more support for their being recorded than when it is a child. I think probably the distinction is obvious there as to the impact on who is being recorded, but it is an interesting distinction that is drawn, I think. And I wonder if that judge in your case, Tina, may have been less critical after this advice has come out, this guidance has come out.
I think that's right. And one of the things that struck me by reading through both sets of guidance, which are pretty similar, and in fact, the authorities, which I did before our discussion, is that, you know, of course, it's not rocket science that if it's a covert recording, by nature, the other person does not know it's being recorded. And you phrase, especially if you're clever, or even if you're not so clever, you phrase your questions, you phrase the context of everything you do within that conversation in a different way because you know it's being recorded and the other person doesn't. And as much as there is loads of advice now, and it's worth reading, it sounds a bit geeky, but it is worth reading the advice because it is quite, you know, it makes you think. Of course I knew that if I was recording somebody, there would be things I didn't say or I said in a different way or I encouraged them to say. But until actually you see it in black and white, as much as the advice goes along the lines of, well, one has to be very careful, it might have been edited, it might have been, you know, picked up in a different AI type situation and you need to look at this and the court needs to think about those things. The whole nature of a conversation, you know, whether it's a conversation between you and I, Jennifer, or a conversation between me and my closest best buddy, you say things to people in different ways, whether it's public or private, don't you? So the whole context of, well, what was being said to the child, and because that person, that parent knew they were recording it. So it's kind of like, I think not only is there that the judicial side of it, the court side, I think there's a whole lot of human nature in there.
Oh, entirely. And I think actually that's why it's interesting that the limited guidance that there is for professionals does appear to differ between social workers and CAFCAS and then the British Psychological Society guidance, which actually says that they are concerned that recording of psychological assessments, for example, may impact the validity of that assessment if people know they are being recorded. And as you say, that's an interesting point about just the impact of human nature on what you're saying and if you're engaging in it in the same way as if you knew it weren't being recorded in that way.
And does that, I haven't read the psychological guidance, but does that psychological guidance touch upon some of the things that are in those two documents, the family justice documents, about if there's loads of it? I think there was one case where there were, I don't know, 600 hours of it. That in itself amounts to harassment, and that in itself amounts to an indication of the power balance or the power imbalance within the relationship. Does the psychological guidance touch upon?
I think the thrust is predominantly the impact on what may or may not be said and how it's said and how the profession is conducting themselves. It's an interesting point because, again, the Family Justice Council guidance deals with harassment in the context, I think, of the private law setting, in saying that it might be a further course of coercive control or controlling behaviour. I'm not sure the Family Justice Council guidance actually deals with if it might constitute harassment of a professional. I'm not sure that's actually something that's explicitly addressed, because it certainly could be, potentially. Although, as against that, I suppose you've then got the argument about, well, if they're doing their job and they're doing it properly, why does that constitute harassment?
Exactly. And if people say to me, can I record this? I say, well, look, some people view that very dimly. If you want to record me, record me, because I'm going to be able to stand by what I say to you. It does make you dead, doesn't it, think twice as a professional sometimes. Well, you might make the odd inappropriate or slightly inappropriate comment, for example, about a judge or an opponent. Or, you know, might not make you, Jennifer, because you probably wouldn't do this. But it does make me think, oh, God, I shouldn't say that. Keep your mouth shut. But it's good. That's good for us, I think, as professionals to, you know, to have to justify what we say.
Yeah, indeed. It will be interesting, I think, to see how the case law around it develops, particularly in regards to recording social workers, because so often there is they didn't give me that advice or they didn't say that. And actually, sometimes it may be that a recording...
Oh, and my experience is that it has shown it's not right. And there's so much, isn't there, in the nuance of how something is said. You and I know how the system works, whether we're talking private law or public law. We know how the system works and we know how the process works. But if you're a parent, somebody saying one thing to you when you've no experience of this might mean something very different. So it's all that nuance as well. It's so difficult. You know, one person hearing one thing, well, we all interpret things differently, don't we? But one person hearing one thing might mean something very different to another person. So I don't discourage it. I kind of always think, well, please don't take a dim view of it. Please, I guess everyone needs to be up front and say, I am going to record you, or can I record you? Shall we have a quick look at what the changes are? I'm looking at the new advice, the most recent one. And in fact, you pointed out to me when we were discussing it earlier that it firms up at paragraph 2.6 on data protection, GDPR, because it was a bit woollier, I thought, in the draft. And this one, in terms of whether it's lawful or not, can you just give us a quick summary on what it says about the lawfulness or otherwise, and what recording a family conversation or recording something for use in court, how does that balance lie?
Indeed. So I think what has happened in the interim is that the Family Justice Council have sought advice from the Information Commissioner's Office. And that is where the guidance, I think, has emanated from in the final draft. It sets out essentially that if you are taking recordings for the purposes of your personal life, so if you're taking videos of people or things like that, it doesn't come within the scope of UK GDPR. However, what the guidance does confirm is that the Information Commissioner's Office confirmed that if data is processed by family members and then used in a professional setting, such as in the home with a social worker present, then it would qualify under the scope of UK GDPR. And then the Information Commissioner goes on to set out further guidance on the detrimental use of data, which is summarised that you must not use children's personal data in ways that have been shown to be detrimental to their well-being. I think in essence that does accord with the previous guidance in the case law and the factors that the court is going to be taking into account, because as always, the welfare of the child is paramount, and the court will have to consider that when it decides how to deal with recordings that have been adduced. However, I think what the thrust of that part of the guidance is going to is probably the sanctions outside of the family court context as to your use of personal data, I mean, if that breaches any other legislation.
And to me, it was clearer that the word process, if you're processing, if you're sharing, if you're using it, those recordings, then it becomes within that group of, well, you have to comply with the UK GDPR. And that to me was much, much clearer in the final draft. And what the final draft of the Family Justice Council guidance helps us with also is what you need to do if you want to rely upon the recording. And it now says very clearly that you need to make a C2 application. You need to provide a summary of what the nature of the recording is, its context, whether it's been edited, the dates, the times, the method of recording, why it was obtained covertly, and the relevance of its contents to the issue in the proceedings. I mean, all that seems to me, Jennifer, really pretty common sense. But the fact that we are now told you need to make that C2, you need to share it in advance. You can't just do what I did and pitch up with the recordings and say, oh, look, I've got a recording. Everybody needs to have the opportunity to deal with it in as objective way as possible. I think that's, you know, that is an improvement. I think that's paragraph 4.18. I think it's a big improvement to what was there before.
Certainly. I think, interestingly, it doesn't specifically provide for transcripts, which I think some of the previous case law had done. Obviously, it will be case specific because, as you say, if you've got 600 hours of recordings, you're unlikely to transcribe all of those recordings. And it, as I say, it will likely be case specific. But it is interesting it doesn't deal specifically with that point.
But it doesn't. But one of the other, it's paragraph 6.3 of the changes, is making suggestions for costs, cost sanctions to cover recording. And that does deal with transcripts because certainly they cite in that paragraph 6.3 that although it's unusual in family courts for there to be costs, that there have been costs orders made in MVF, covert recording of children, and the father was ordered to pay £1,500 transcription charges and £9,000 toward the mother's cost in respect of the recording. So although transcriptions are not there per se, it's a penalty. It's unusual, isn't it? It's an unusual penalty to, I guess it's sort of a veiled threat, as costs always are. It's one of those things that in the family courts, it's very tricky to deal with anybody. Actually, cost is always quite a scary moment in any case. But interestingly, how that is something to be taken into account as a separate and distinct issue, you know, covertly record at your peril, because if we find it's wrong, or if you've incurred costs because of it, you will be paying the costs.
Indeed, yes. I think that case in particular makes quite clear the very real risks of, certainly again in the private law context, I'm not quite sure it would apply in the same way in public law, but in the private law context, the risks that are involved in making covert recordings and then adducing them. Because obviously the bar for costs orders is so high that actually by ordering costs, the court has made very clear its views as to the conduct that led to those recordings being made.
Yeah, and I think the final bit I would like to touch upon in respect of the new advice is the section 7 and 9, which really are sort of an attempt to develop a policy on overt recordings. And I know you covered this in your seminar when you did that in March last year. Because it's a little bit contradictory, I think, because, you know, advice on covert recordings, by their nature, they're covert. Developing a policy on overt recordings, we've already dealt with a bit on the fact that CAFCAS has advice for their guardians about being open to somebody saying, I want to record. But it's a very difficult thing, isn't it, for a client, private or public, I think, very often to say, well, I'm recording you because I don't trust you, in effect. I mean, I suppose the other thing you could be putting forward is, I'm recording you because there's so much to take in. I'm going to need to have to go back to this later and think about it. So I think those attempts at policy making in terms of, listen, we should all stand by our professional opinions and advice, and we should all behave appropriately at all times, might bear fruit. What do you think?
I think taking into account the power imbalance is often there if a social worker is in someone's home. I think it probably would be very difficult for a client to say, I'm now going to record this. And they presumably will be asked why by that professional if they say they want to record it. So I think if there is a policy in place that everyone is aware of, and for example, if local authorities made parents aware of it, it would potentially put them in a bit of a stronger position if they wanted to do that. And I can see how that might assist, and also may assist the court in what to do with those recordings when they have been obtained. So I think it would likely assist. I can see, though, that it may involve a culture shift that might take a while to implement.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm looking at paragraph 9.2 of the latest guidance, the final guidance. And it says, guidance developed by the Professional Association for Children's Guardians, Family Court Advisors, Independent Social Workers, NALGRO. identifies constructive reasons to adhere to a request to record meetings, thereby avoiding some of the risks and problems associated with covert recordings. I think for me, one of the interesting things about that, and I would always say, yes, people do ask from time to time. And I always say, yeah, of course, you go ahead, you record me. But I think in the cases I've done, the one I was giving you the example of earlier, where the judge really took umbrage and said to the client, my client, did you tell them you were recording this? Did they know you were recording it? And to her, it wasn't the fact of the recording. It was the fact that she hadn't told the professionals that she was recording it. And I understand that, but I also understand that if you look at the motivation for recording, it's because of that lack of trust. So I think, as you say, it's going to take a little while, isn't it, to be that culture change that, you know, that we probably would like to see. Were there any other things in the final guidance, Jennifer, that you thought were particularly significant? I quite like the Appendix 4, which was the Litigants in Person Guide to Covert Recording. It's kind of a little two-page guidance to what you should be doing and why you shouldn't be doing it. And I just thought that actually was like an idiot's guide to covert recording, which I think just actually should have been for the lawyers and not for the litigants in person. Because I think it is helpful for people to know what we should be doing and what we can't do.
Indeed. And it's probably quite a useful resource to discuss it with clients, that appendix, to just summarise what exactly the approach the court will take is. So yes, I certainly agree that is definitely helpful.
Yeah, so if anyone wants to go have a look at that, it's Appendix 4, and it really is almost one side of A4, just setting out what we've been talking about, and applications need to be made, and the advice about asking permission to record. It's really simple stuff, but it makes you think, and I think maybe now if I was in a case where I suspected someone was going to record, I'd almost just print it out and send it to them and say, look, just bear this in mind.
Great. Well, as Tina said earlier, there is a fuller seminar with some slides that is available on the 42BR website. So by all means, go and have a look at that. Thank you very much for tuning in to 42 Talks. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. To listen to other episodes, follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts.